Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as ever, for tuning in. We hope this story will amuse you. That's the worst one we're going to have today. Hi, I'm Ben.
Yeah, we hope it serves. I'm Noel. We hope it serves as a bit of an amuse-bouche for whatever else you've got going on today. We're talking about cows. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about not only cows, we're talking about Guernsey cows, which is a thing I didn't know about. And We're talking about cows with really cool names. And we're talking about cows that lived in Antarctica. Because Antarctica is not really known for its hospitable climate, let's say. And, you know, cows are sort of creature comfort type beasts. They like to, you know, chew on grass and graze and laze around until, you know, they get slaughtered or whatever. But the milk ones, typically they're like, you know, treated like a member of the family, right, Ben? So how did milk cows end up on such a frozen wasteland as Antarctica?
Yeah, this was a question I posed to our super producer, Casey Pegram, who not only refused to answer, but said he would not appear on today's show. I'm kidding. That's not why he's making some major moves. But this is a great story. It involves an historical figure that's always fascinated me, Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd. Antarctica. Byrd. Cows. These cows did have interesting names. Here's just to set the scene real quick. Admiral Byrd took a number of expeditions to Antarctica. And in 1933, on his second expedition, he had some new individuals join his crew. Klondike Gay Neera, Deerfoot Guernsey Maid, and Foremost Southern Girl. And another individual born in the course of the trip. These don't sound like people names, do they? They shouldn't, because these are the names of three Guernsey cows.
That's right. And they spent more than a year as, you know, producing dairy cows on the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica. And then in 1935, they returned back to the civilized world, and they were like celebrity cows. So, you know, let's think about all the logistics that take just to even get to Antarctica. You know, it's a pretty brutal sea voyage. I mean, as we know, like nothing grows there. It's almost like living on the moon or something. You got to be a particular type of adventurer to even want to spend any time there. Well, I'm sure it's gorgeous. A lot can go wrong.
Yeah.
So typically it's the realm of, you know, pioneering kind of adventuring explorers or scientists.
Yeah, this is one of those places that I got close to visiting, Noel, but I wasn't able to make it happen. I was trying to travel with a group just to conserve costs. The average cost going to Antarctica is like 10 grand per person. You can get it as low as 5 grand, but it's even now in the modern day, just as a civilian, it's tough to get there. It was even tougher during Admiral Byrd's time to understand why he took these cows with him on his second expedition. We have to explore what happened on his first expedition. Now, Byrd was a big deal, big, big deal. Born 1888, died 1957, lived a lot of life in his time. He was a naval officer. He was a pioneer in the world of aviation, and he was a polar explorer. Today, he's probably best known for those explorations of Antarctica. So his early experiences after graduating the U.S. Naval Academy in 1912 inspired him to make a life goal, a bucket list. His experience flying over the sea ice and the glaciers of Greenland had inspired him. You know, they gave him a hunger. He wanted to fly over the North Pole.
Yeah, and not just to see Santa's workshop, because that's definitely at the North Pole. But on May 9th, 1926, Byrd navigated a flight with Floyd Bennett as serving as his pilot. And they made what they purported to be the first airplane journey over the North Pole. They flew from Kings Bay, Spitsbergen, Norway, to the North Pole, and then returned. And that was a 15 and a half hour flight. And apparently everything went off without a hitch, aside from a tiny little snafu in the form of an oil leak from the starboard engine. And their plane was a Fokker tri-motor airplane. I love the name Fokker, I'm not going to lie. They both received the U.S. Congressional Medal of Honor for their heroism and their intrepidude, because that's also a word. Though there was some skepticism from certain members of the press and the public as to whether their plane actually reached the North Pole. But that's a story for another day. Harumph, indeed. That's a story for another day. We're not going to give airtime to these harumphers.
Mm-hmm. People wouldn't get lost in that. They didn't get in the weeds about the facts, because Byrd was what they would call a smoke show. The man was a snack. He was dashing. He was handsome. He had been in the Navy. No one had died on any of his expeditions so far. So people were like, let him have this. He's pretty much a celebrity. He did lose out on the prize for the first solo transatlantic flight. Charles Lindbergh beat him there. And he was very disappointed about this. He didn't know what to do. He was in the doldrums. He was sad. He was in his feelings, as we would say in the parlance of our modern times. And that's when he met one of my favorite historical figures, Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, the man largely responsible for the 1954 invasion of Guatemala on the U.S. part, and the reason you have bacon for breakfast, also the nephew of Sigmund Freud. We've got a good episode or two about him over at Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Bernays said this to Byrd, who was very depressed at the time. He says, you know, Byrd, why don't you put Antarctica on the map for Americans? Because previously, Antarctica had been dominated in a way by people from the UK and people from Norway. But no one at this point in history had ever actually flown over the icy southern waste. As a matter of fact, people had some pretty wild beliefs about it because no one had flown over it. They said, you know, there might be dinosaurs there. There might be lost tribes of uncontacted humans. Nobody really knew what they would find. And also shout out to the Savage Land of Marvel Comics, which is inspired by some of these beliefs. So Byrd took his advice, didn't he?
That's right. In 1928, Byrd decided that he wanted to explore unknown parts of Antarctica from the air. He received backing from quite a few financiers, including Edsel Ford and John D. Rockefeller, because like you said, Ben, he was a hottie. He was a public figure. He was the modern equivalent of like a reality show star or something like that. And he inspired confidence in these investors who believed that he could get the job done and that it would be a good investment and a good kind of PR move. So he actually, beyond that, was able to inspire members of the public, yes, the public, to contribute their own money, which was estimated to have raised somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000. Because like you said, Ben, it's no cheap trip to go to Antarctica. So he mounted his first, this is also to finance a series of expeditions, not just one. So he mounted his first voyage to the Antarctic in 1928 through 1930. That was it would have been the biggest expedition ever to have been seen at the time to the continent. He sailed south in October of 1928, and he set up a very state-of-the-art and stocked base called Little America, It was built, as we mentioned at the top of the show, on the Ross Ice Shelf, which is a very wide ice, glacial kind of plain, a shelf of ice that is bordering the Ross Sea near an indentation of a cliff of ice named the Bay of Whales, as in the big swimmy boys, whales. So they flew to and from this base over the Antarctic continent to observe, to see what they could see, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And to step back here, this is a lot, the excitement here is a lot like the excitement of landing people on the moon. That is how far away and mysterious and enigmatic Antarctica seems this time. So on November 29th, 1929, Byrd and three compatriots make the first flight over the South Pole in human history. Byrd is the navigator. They fly from Little America and back in 19 hours. They make history, and nothing goes wrong. And for this achievement, Byrd will later be promoted to Rear Admiral. Fast forward, 1933 to 1935. Byrd is almost a brand name now in the rarefied world of Antarctic expeditions. So there's a second Byrd expedition. They're back in Little America. They say this time we're going to map the area around the pole. We're also going to lay claim to this land for Uncle Sam. And also we're going to bring these cows. And here's what happens. There are three main reasons for them to bring cattle with them on this expedition. For background, if you haven't gotten the sense of this yet, Antarctica is a punishing place. If you were to look at a list of the known inhabitants, it's pretty small. There's 67 different types of insects. You got seals, you got penguins, and you got researchers and support staff. So a lot of the stuff that Byrd and his expeditionary forces would need to survive had to be brought with them from a less inhospitable clime. And that's why they went to these three reasons that convinced them it was a smart idea to bring cattle. Number one, solving what was called the milk problem, which is not a weird avant-garde album, but it could be. It could be.
No, it's all about sustainability. It kind of makes me think again of like a biodome situation, or like a, you know, a theoretical moon or Martian colony. You'd want to be able to grow and sustain your own food, since the actual habitat would not sustain that. So you have to kind of, you know, take it into your own hands. So here's the thing. Admiral Byrd really liked his milk a lot. He purportedly drank 2 quarts of Guernsey milk a day. And this is all from the reporting of the time, you know, because this is also, not only was this like something that was very functional for him, it was also a big story because, you know, as we talked about, the logistics of getting human beings to Antarctica is absolute nightmare, let alone milk cows, which are, you know, like we said, very kind of, they need to be babied a little bit, let's just say. It would take a lot of doing to get them there in one piece. Another article said that although Byrd had brought plenty of dried and evaporated milk, he really needed that fresh Guernsey milk to start his day. So the cows were there to solve that milk problem. And by the 30s, fresh milk was like a big kind of, you know, talk about the milk campaign of the 90s. In the 30s, milk was seen as this like kind of standard bearer of health and vitality. So it was really easy to say, I've got to have my milk. How am I supposed to explore and adventure if I don't have my fresh milk?
Yep. And whenever there's this marketing piece of giant projects like this, I always wonder whether Bernays had a hand in the milk jug here. The weird thing is, it didn't have to be fresh Guernsey milk. We know that powdered or malted milk could have some of these same results. Previous expeditions, just like the famous Roald Amundsen expedition, have been just fine with powdered milk. Also, there was a sponsor for Byrd's second Antarctic expedition. I mean, there were lots of sponsors, but one of the sponsors was William Horlick of the apparently world famous Horlick's Malted Milk, which is still a thing. And for funding this, by the way, this malted milk tycoon did get a mountain range named after him. So that's our first reason of three. Fresh milk wasn't actually a health requirement. Other forms of milk were available. So why go to the trouble of lugging these cows and all their cow stuff across the ice? Well, there's a second reason, and that reason is publicity, baby. Let's get this in the minds of the public. Let's get this in the newspaper headlines. Let's have some human interest here. There's a great paper by Elizabeth Lane and Han E.F. Nielsen, which proves that Byrd did have another motive, which was publicity. He knew that he would get some love in the press for being the first person to fly over the South Pole. But this second expedition, it needed to get zhuzhed up a little because it focused on scientific endeavors, measuring ice caps, spotting meteors. It didn't have as many dramatic stunts. So adding the cows here made the press more likely to cover it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and those researchers that you mentioned, Ben, added that the cows created some novelty and newsworthiness to an expedition, which, in contrast to Byrd's first Antarctic venture, threatened to be a little bit dull. So this kind of added a little bit of spice to it. And it created more news opportunities and more sponsorship opportunities and fundraising. So everybody likes a good first, right? So the first milk cows on Antarctica, that makes for a pretty sexy headline. And since the expedition was privately funded, and Byrd was a fantastic media kind of attractor, like he was really good at getting coverage for all the reasons we mentioned, his backers did expect to get paid back or to get a return on their investment, whether it was in the form of publicity for their products or, you know, mentions of their companies or what have you on these regular radio updates that took place with the expedition. That's kind of funny. It's almost like the equivalent of like being a race car driver and like wearing all of these like sponsors logos on your racing uniform. He would literally have to name drop these sponsors. So, you know, at the time, it would have been a pretty fair conclusion to draw that the real reason that Byrd took the cows was for that publicity, first and foremost. But it turns out that he may also have had a little bit more of a shadowy political motivation.
Yes, reason number three, a geopolitical motivation. See, nothing exists in a vacuum, folks. And cows had this association in history and the zeitgeist with settlement, with colonial settlement. The U.S. had fallen a little bit behind in empire building over the course of the late 1800s, the early 20th century. By the time the 1920s and 30s came around, a bunch of other countries, Argentina, Great Britain, France, they had claimed chunks of Antarctica, and the U.S. was at a geographic disadvantage. You know what I mean? It's pretty far away from the South Pole. So Byrd wanted to establish a slice of the pie for the U.S. Even little America, by the way, was founded on land that the British had laid claim to. So he thought, if I build this place like a frontier town and I call it Little America, then we can, you know, we can inculcate ourselves. We can stake a permanent claim. And so in his mind, when he thinks of this kind of frontier Wild West vibe, he says, what is a little America without a little dairy farm? It makes sense if you've been brainstorming in the writer's room for a while.
Yes, exactly. You're a little punchy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's true. It was that kind of level of homesteading, right? Mm-hmm. Almost.
Because you can't just stick a flag in and say it's yours. You have to have a settlement based on the Hughes Doctrine.
That's right. You got to put the work in. The Hughes Doctrine says that a claim has to be based on a settlement, not just the virtue of discovery. So how does one show a settlement or the evidence of a settlement on a continent that's absolutely inhospitable and covered in ice? So these were all borderline symbolic gestures, right? Like the idea of setting up a post office or having a small farm, or the presence of like domesticated animals and cattle, since they are kind of like have this legacy as sort of these bellwethers of colonialism and frontier settlement. It was all about optics. Bird was a master at kind of like painting this narrative, right?
Yeah.
It made people get nostalgic for the good old days of frontier settling and, you know, like going out on the range and making a new world of your own. You know, I mean, it really was. He was kind of selling dreams here a little bit.
And this symbolism was successful in the American press. The U.S. ultimately did not end up making a claim to any large sector of Antarctica. So the press worked, but it didn't work long term. Anyhow, let's talk about the journey for the actual cows. You know what I mean? The actual, I guess, the symbols of the story. So in 1933, these three cows are loaded onto the SS Jacob Rupert. Of course, we mentioned there was Foremost Southern Girl. She's from New York, Deerfoot Guernsey Maid from Massachusetts, and Klondike Gay Neera is from North Carolina. Klondike is the one who is pregnant. That's why a bull is born on the way. Bird had struck this deal with the American Guernsey Cattle Club, and the carpenter of the expedition was also in charge of the cattle. And then all the other stuff that supported the cows, how clever is this? It came from donations from those sponsors we talked about. Someone's like, here's 10 tons of feed. Someone else is like, here's a bunch of farm equipment for little America. And then someone's like, here's a milking machine. This is a great gig. You know what I mean? And the cows had an okay life on board.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? 3 months, I think it took.
3 months. Can you imagine? Like I said, they need a little bit of hand-holding, these cows. They can easily get spooked, and they really do need to be taken care of, or else they can waste away. And, you know, an unhappy cow does not make good milk. That's just a fact. Everybody knows that.
Yeah. So the calf that's born, this bull, is named Iceberg. And it's like the child in The Mandalorian. To avoid spoilers, this becomes a media darling. And all the newspapers are like, Iceberg born on the trip to Antarctica, the foundation of little America, et cetera, et cetera. It's great. But the cows' lives in Antarctica were actually pretty rough. Surprise. I don't think that's a spoiler. Their lives kind of, in terms of quality of life, it was very low. They didn't have a lot of cow fun, and they didn't have a lot of cow room.
What do cows do for fun? They just sort of prance? Graze.
Cows like music. Cows form deep emotional bonds. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see cows dance sometimes if they like stuff. It's true.
This is completely unrelated, but if anyone is familiar with the very interesting and psychedelic animator, Syriac, I think his last name is Harris, he has a really great video. It's called Cows and Cows and Cows. And I highly recommend you checking it out. It involves dancing cows, and it's done with After Effects, and it is absolutely a delight. Look for Cows and Cows and Cows to see some super trippy cow dancing.
And if the cows in Little America were dancing, they weren't dancing in a very big space. They didn't have a lot of room. When the ship landed, the cows were taken from the vessel by crane and they were put on the ice. One of the cows immediately tried to go back on the ship and was like, this is not cool. This is not the outside I know. And the four cows, remember, because Iceberg was born on the way, they're moved into a little underground dog town. And the only relaxation they had was a weekly walk down the tunnels. And then they would get, you know, all these wild puppies from the 126 huskies that lived there, too. All these wild puppies would, like, jump all over them and want to play with them. And the only grass they eat is, like, a year old. So the people on the ground are saying, you know, the cows are not having a great time. And other people are saying, when they get back, they're going to be worth $20,000. And we'll all, you know, they'll be celebrities. But it seemed like it was I don't know. It seemed like it was tough. And you can tell from writing of the times that the cows were having a tough life too. Klondike even got frostbite and had to be put down.
R.I.P. Klondike. Yeah, I mean, it, like we said, it's not really a place where cows would typically thrive. So there is, you know, when you think about the motivation that went into this, and you think about the political and the optical kind of like press motivations, putting these cows through those situations, it kind of borders on animal cruelty in some respects, wouldn't you say, Ben?
Yeah, you could tell because their milk production falls off pretty quickly. Bird himself notes that originally the cows gave up to 40 quarts of milk a day, and this later slowed to a trickle. So after Klondike, unfortunately, passes away, the other cows do survive. And eventually, the three other cows, counting Iceberg, remember, baby Iceberg, he's our baby Yoda of this, eventually they make it back to the U.S., but the whole time they're in there, in Antarctica, and the whole time that they're on the way back, the U.S., various members of the U.S. public and business sphere are making money hand over fist, capitalizing on this, because no one owns the rights to talk about the cows, right? So New York newspapers are using it as their human interest or cattle interest story.
Totally. And then we've got the sponsors again, Laro Dairy Feed, which, you know, sponsored the expedition and provided the food for the cows, put out a leaflet about the, quote, first cows to ever venture into the frozen wastes of the South Pole region, in addition to that newspaper coverage you mentioned. And then when Bird returned from a not particularly successful solo expedition, it was written in the Guernsey Breeders Journal, an article that detailed his recovery. He was very malnourished when he got back, and it detailed how milk, with its calcium-rich bounty, got him back on his feet. And they called it, quote, "The milk really pulled me out of my tailspin."
Nice. And the cows were celebrities, too. They got this joyous welcome upon their return. People were jubilant to see Iceberg in person. And the cows were given hay cocktails at these ritzy hotels. They were even featured on the front page of the New York Times, which is the definition of making it. And these hay cocktails were, this is interesting. The New York Times, as we said, writes about this on May 15th, 1935. The hay cocktails are heaps of hay with cracked ice, which I think is the very last thing those cows would want after being in Antarctica for so long. Also, Southern Girl was indifferent to the speeches made by the various people of note at the Commodore Hotel. And Southern Girl never lost this shaggy winter coat she grew during the expedition. They made media appearances. They did the circuit. Their legend spread via a documentary called Guernsey's Discover Antarctica. And they stayed in the U.S. Bird went to the Antarctic multiple other times, and he played a huge role in establishing McMurdo Station, the American base. But he never bought cows with him again. And at this point, in 2021, keep having to remind myself, Noel, it's 2021, nobody has brought a cow there since. This was the only time so far. So if you want to make history and you've got $10,000 to get yourself down there and you've got a number of sponsors to help you get some cattle down there, then you could give it a go.
I got to say, Ben, I mean, if it's $10,000 for a perfectly mobile, you know, human, what must it be for a cow that would require specialized equipment and, you know, housing and to get into not only to get on the, you know, the flight or the ship voyage, but then to get across the frozen tundra to the base? I mean, if it's 10K for a human, I bet it's got to be three times that for a cow.
Yeah, and you know, I don't mean to be a grumpy Guernsey about it, but I don't see I don't see much potential for cows to visit there again in the near future. But what a story. And this is just one of many of Bird's adventures. Highly recommend you check out some of his other stuff, like Operation High Jump.
What's that?
This is something that's a lot of fun for people who believe in conspiratorial things. But according to the U.S. Navy, Operation High Jump took place in 1946 through 47, and they were testing how to train people in frigid conditions, and they were also trying to extend U.S. sovereignty over the Antarctic continent. It's great. It's good reading. It doesn't have very much cow content, though. So if you're reading stories for cows, I would stick with I would stick with some other stuff. You know, maybe a Wild West story.
Well, I will. If you want something that does have a lot of cow content, premium cow content, check out the documentary Guernsey's Discover Antarctica, which apparently has some footage of little iceberg, quote, frisking on the ice barrier at the tender age of 2 months. This was made after all three of those cows retired, and this kind of is their legacy. As you mentioned, Ben, Bird did continue to make multiple expeditions to the Antarctic and eventually established the current American base there, McMurdo Station. What a tale.
What a tale. And we are moving on today, get it? But we would like to hear from you. Let us know some of your favorite animal stories from days gone by, especially if they're obscure and especially if they're super weird. You can find us on the internet. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We like to recommend Ridiculous History on Facebook. We got some brand new mods. Go say hello to them. And while you're online, you can also find us as individuals.
You can find me. I am at How Now Noel Brown on Instagram. How about you, Ben?
I am at Ben Bullen HSW on Twitter. I am also at Ben Bullen on Instagram. And I just got onto this thing called Clubhouse, which is pretty interesting.
Wait, you got into Clubhouse?
Yeah. I'm a Clubhouse guy now.
How'd you get into Clubhouse? I thought it was very exclusive. I want to get into Clubhouse.
Well, I'm still trying it out. We'll see how it works out.
What, did you have to get an invite? You got an inside scoop, Ben?
Yeah, it was a weird series of events. You know what I mean? It's because of my standing in the Antarctic cattle industry.
Interesting. Okay. Well, hook a brother up, Ben. I've been dying to try out some Clubhouse. Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram here in spirit, along with Christopher Hasiotis looking down on us from on high. Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster, Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
And, of course, Gabe Lucia, our own Admiral Bird. Also, thanks, of course, to our peer podcaster, Eves Jeffcoat. Please check out This Day in History class. I do want to recommend, you know, if you can't, I don't know. If you got to go to one poll, you can either take the 50 Let Pobody, which is a Russian icebreaker, to the North Pole. That means 50 years of victory. Or you can get to Antarctica. I want to hear from someone who's been to Antarctica. Man, would you ever go?
I think I would consider it if I had the right crew.
Mm-hmm. Just to do like a reenactment of the thing?
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. I want that part where like the weird wolf tentacle monster pops out of my chest cavity.
I guess we'll, you're going to do the thing? Going to do the line?
I'm going to do the thing. What's the line?
The line. Say we'll see you next time.
Oh, yeah. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.